This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Antonioni's Blow Up is a film about photography masquerading as a detective story. One could describe The Miracle of Analogy or The History of Photography Part 1 as a detective story masquerading as a history of photography. Once upon a time, the story goes, the world was present, but it was kidnapped and sequestered away due to the influence of several factors, which I'll summarize here in capsule form. The first of these was a Cartesian attempt to establish man's self-sovereignty and the triumph of mind over matter by more or less philosophizing the world out of existence. The second was the privileging of photography's dry, mechanical aspects over its liquid, vital aspects, the dry features being associated with the ease and instantaneity of a point-and-click snapshot, the liquid features with the slow, durational, semi-magical processes of the darkroom. The third factor was the suppression of photography's social, dialogical, and even republic-creating qualities in favor of its status as infinitely reproducible commodity. In Kaja Silverman's book, though, the world emerges afresh from these attempts to bracket it out of belief and appearance. In fact, you show that it was hiding in plain view all along, and that it will find another path to visibility if we attempt to suppress it once more. The Miracle of Analogy is, in a way, in an analogical relationship to your previous book, Flesh of My Flesh. This relationship is analogical in precisely the way you define in both of these books. That is, the new book continues the project of the previous one, but not in the sense of a sequel or next episode in a series. It develops out of its predecessor in the photographic sense of that word, and also mirrors an image back to it, pressing its thought onward while still adhering closely to it, preserving the touch of a metonymic connection. The Miracle of Analogy calls back to Flesh of My Flesh with references to Leonardo, Richter, Proust, and other figures from the earlier book, thereby overlapping with it in corners as in a double exposure. It also forms a sort of negative or reversal pair with that text, exploring similar ideas by other means. Both of these books tell stories about the interconnectedness of the world of things and the world of appearances. In Flesh of My Flesh, you begin this story with the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice and the philosophical writings of Nietzsche, Freud, and Lou Andreas Salome, and conclude with works of contemporary art, ending with Richter's October 18, 1977 paintings, which you describe as a form of photography by other means. In the new book, by contrast, the journey from writing to image is reversed. You begin with photographs and photography, narrating a new history of this medium that greatly expands its purview and capacities, and you end with a theorist, Walter Benjamin, as well as a beautiful reading of the book's cover image by John Dugdale, which we'll get to later in the program. These two texts, taken as a pair, demonstrate one of their own primary claims, that the smallest unit of being is two. The Miracle of Analogy is also in a weakly messianic relationship to other books in your oeuvre. In World Spectators, you first wrote about appearance in a non-representational sense, the notion that images are not alienated from their reference and not the kind of signs that cause the world to fade away. In James Coleman, you turn to the Irish artist's superimposed slide installations to think about photography as a palimpsest of black and white erasures and reversals thereof, as in the intimate relationship of a photographic positive with its negative, or that of a stereoscopic image with its twin. In speaking about Godard, a book that you co-authored with Haroun Farrakhi, you used the word analogy during a discussion of adaptation. Godard's Contempt, like the whole collection of works that have sprung forth from the Odyssey, is much more than a replica or variation. Rather, it expands the Odyssey's field and shakes its literary pedestal. You also describe the island of Capri, where that film is set, as a place where past and present coexist. As we learn in the new book, a photograph is also such a place, when it is met by the eyes of an addressee. And finally, as in your analysis of Godard's self-portrait film, JLG, JLG, you describe the art of image making as an act of receiving, not taking, capturing, or shooting, as everyday language would have it, not creating out of a void, as in the romantic sense of artistic production, not possessing or controlling, as modern technologies attempt to do, and not even making an imprint or index, as in Charles Peirce's account. In The Miracle of Analogy, you prove that speculative claim, grounding it in meticulous history. In retrospect, all of these texts seem to have been awaiting this new fellow traveler. Analogy is once again the proper term for that relationship. The new book does not trump its predecessors, it does not negate them, as in the suturing action of classical editing, nor does it mechanically reproduce them or stage their eternal return. It analogizes them, turning round to look back, while also craning to look forward from the vantage point of the present. The most exciting thing that this book does, in my view, is to reestablish photography as the means by which the world becomes present, not, as the assumption has been in recent decades, the means by which we mark or commemorate the world's absence. This shift in thinking has marvelous, profound consequences, and it is one that I think many of us have been eagerly awaiting.
We don't have much time, and there's so much to unpack in your text and to give people a preview of. So I think we should start at the very beginning. And one thing I want to foreground for anyone who thinks that a history of photography is somehow going to be about technological progress is looking in the wrong place. This is a very deep reading of the linguistic, the social, the psychic, and the sensorial in a way that really takes a lot of familiar characters from the history of photography and moments that you probably have heard of before, but shifts the focus, reorients you in really surprising ways and pulls out things that you might not have paid attention to in the past to totally remap your understanding of them. So I think that's one of the very important maneuvers that you make throughout the book time and again. So let's start at the beginning. What prompted you to embark on what's now just the beginning of a long journey?
Well, you know, Freud says you can never come to the end of an interpretation of a dream, and to describe where this book began, it feels something like that, there are so many places where it began. The other day when the three of us were having lunch, Homé said, "It's so strange you're asked to write occasional essays about artists, and it seems a digression away from what you really want to do, and then in some mysterious way, it turns into the next step in the place you were already going to." So I think that the beginning was the moment after I finished World Spectators, as Homé suggested, where I had theorized perception in receptive terms and as a response to a solicitation from the world and the sensory world as existing in the form of a kind of gift. And the solicitation, as I discussed it, was for affirmation, a kind of appeal, a call to us to affirm it. And somebody said to me after that, "It's an awfully pastoral book. Where are the people?" And I thought, yeah, that I was able to write such a deeply affirmative book only by bracketing out the social. So that was one starting point for this book, which is massively about human relationality, much more centered on that than on the world perceiver relationship, although that is still there. But also, I was thinking the next book has got to be about photography. I published World Spectators in 2000, and I thought the next book has to be about photography because in some mysterious way, it is the medium or form, it mimes this thing I've been talking about, this meeting of world and look, and that was very mysterious, and I embarked upon a study of photography at that point. But then, as Homé said, I was asked to write an essay about Jean-Luc Godard, and it was about his JLG, his autobiography for, it was actually an exhibition of his video work, and I found the receiver. I just finished recently writing a book about Godard, but I hadn't been thinking about reception, and there it was again, and I wrote an essay called The Author's Receiver. So those are two of the starting points. The other one was, again, a commissioned essay. In this case, one I was gnashing my teeth over because I knew it was going to take a year out of my writing life. And the essay was a response to, it was an homage, or it was a response to a request to write an essay about the place that Mika Ball's thought has in my own. And that's when I began this book proper, with an essay called Je Vous that I published in several different locations. But Proust came into the equation, and Proust has always been there, and so we could say that Proust is intimately about photography, and my involvement with Proust goes back to graduate school, or probably to my undergraduate years, when I would read it and exclaim, "It's so true, it's so true, it's so true." And Leo and I are always arguing over the place of Proust in the great pantheon, and of course he is at the very apex of my literary pantheon. So all of those things came together, but there was a big delay, which was Flesh of My Flesh. History intervened, and I found myself responding to things that were very historically specific. And so now I'm writing this book, which follows both from World Spectators and from Flesh of My Flesh, and, as Homé said, from The Author's Receiver. But I could give many other accounts. It's kind of like when people used to say to me, "Kaja, that's a beautiful name. Where does it come from?" And I would have these elaborate fictions. Now I just say, and everybody's always tremendous. It used to be like Russian grandmother, the Russian steps, you know, et cetera, et cetera. my Scandinavian family. Anyway.
So here's maybe a sequitur from that, which is, I remember when I was your TA, you taught Swan's Way, and we read the beautiful prelude, and of course it's as if the whole set of volumes develops out of
the cup of tea,
and that in turn is a metaphor for thinking about the liquid aspects of appearance and photography. And so just to kind of orient people in the book, there's a chapter about the camera obscura and how it's really a non-photographic kind of photography. It's a moving image that is received on a kind of large plate without being captured there. And then we have this wonderful chapter about Jeff Wall's notion of liquid photography and the idea that with the rise of instant technologies and the idea that we ship and sequester away the development process and the kind of elimination of the darkroom chemicals, as well as the durational aspects of long exposure photography, we're essentially making it more mechanical and drier, and what's lost is not simply darkroom technology as such, but this whole sort of relationship to the form, which thinks about it as a kind of development over time that is precarious and contingent. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the liquid photography.
Yeah, did I sufficiently answer your question?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
just so we have, yeah.
Virgins, wise and foolish. Turns out lots of people were interested in this particular parable in the 19th century around the same time, but I'm not ready to talk about virgins just yet. One has to be really work up to that. To finish what I was saying as the link to, or to finish what I would have said if I'd known what Homé was going to say, the camera obscura, when I started researching it, I found this word to receive everywhere as instead of the word to take, it was a receptive apparatus and the experience for centuries. It was always that word was going into the camera obscura and trying to find the place where the image came into focus and holding a piece of paper or a cloth and receiving this thing that clearly originated in the external world. And that was astonishing. At first I thought, oh, that's amazing. But then, of course, it went on and on and on for centuries, as I said. And when the camera obscura becomes much more technologized, turned into a kind of drawing machine for human beings, the word receive is replaced by the word to take, which is the exact same thing that happens early in the history of photography. Again, this word to receive is massively there in the early vocabulary, and it actually took pretty much a century or a significant part of a century for that transition to occur, but it happened through the foregrounding of the ballistic and optical side of photography over the liquid, as Homme was saying. So what did I not respond to of what you asked me?
No, I think that was enough.
But I think that's interesting then, because you also then map out how it becomes to capture and then to shoot.
Yeah.
And I think that relationship, I mean, we could think about, you know, the kind of connection to photography and the military industrial complex.
Absolutely.
And this kind of increasing aggression towards our relationship to the image.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it has radical consequences. A year after, well, photography is finally quietened down. So let me just say quickly that this is a non-medium specific account of photography. So it develops through the camera obscura and then through chemical photography. But its name is development, and it isn't tied to a specific medium. It's as if the world is speaking to us, and when we manage to seal off the places where it is entering or the opportunity that it is found to address us, which we always do, it moves elsewhere, it develops in another direction. Mm-hmm. And so it starts developing in some ways that are not so recognizably photographic at a certain moment in time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the year after the release of the first marketing of the first point and shoot camera, which it was 1888, George Eastman's Kodak, the first mass-produced camera. The very next year, a pictorial photographer, Emerson, writes, "Photography is the greatest weapon given to man for his intellectual development." So it doesn't take very long to move from taking to freezing to capturing to killing. And photography was industrialized. The industrialization speeded up hugely during the Civil War.
And I want to get back to this idea of a non-medium-specific notion of photography, because that's something Homme and I were talking about earlier, but I want to pick up on her question about something that's more durational, because we so often think of the photographic as static, and you make a very clear point early on, I think, with the camera obscura, with the images moving across, you know, the wall, but then also thinking about early photography before it was fully fixed, and Niepce's experiments fading out of visibility, or the long exposure that captures multiple periods of time, and if you can talk a little bit about the question of time in photography and how you're mapping it out.
Piggyback on that.
I mean, I'm thinking also maybe we could put up one of the
Morel's
camera obscura photographs, just so we have something kind of to ground us in an image. So there's that one, or maybe that one.
Right. Which again, maybe also relates to what Homme was talking about with this question of the liquid versus the optical, which Jeff Wall can posit.
Right. There are a number of contemporary photographers who are working with 19th century processes and with the camera obscura, Zoe Leonard, as well as Abelard de Morel and Vera Lutter, an interesting German photographer. And both Vera Lutter and well, actually, I guess all three of them are grafting photography onto the camera obscura. They are making works that are both photographs and in which a room functions as the camera into which the image comes and where the reception comes manifestly from the external world. So it is returned to its receptive properties, but also it's durational because the exposures are very, very, very long. And so my notion is that photography is not we are receivers, not producers or creators. It isn't a representation or an index, it's an analogy. It's not fixed, it's unstoppably developmental, to come to the development part. And that development happens in many, many different ways. It happens across mediums, it happens from the analog to the digital, it happened from the camera obscura to the photographic, it moved to literature and philosophy and psychoanalysis for a long period of time. And so to come back to the specific question that Alex was asking me, it took Fox Talbot an incredibly long time to stabilize his photographs, decades really. And he published in the 1840s a book of plates, and many of them faded away. They had to be reproduced. One cannot avoid this language, unfortunately. He had to receive them all over again. And they would blacken, they would fade. All of these things are seen as failures, but they are, in my reading, internal to photography. They are part of what development means, this kind of instability. And in the 1850s, 1860s, actually, some of Fox Talbot's works were shown, and a reviewer wrote that they faded before the eyes of the assembled nations, which I think is fantastic beyond belief. So they seem to be in a state, as Gail Buckland, a very perceptive Talbot scholar, puts it, they seem to be becoming in a state of perpetual becoming. And I think that even after a photographic image has been so-called stabilized, it continues to develop in all kinds of other ways. So development both in the way we normally understand it, analogy is a profound fluid of development. It's the one that happens in Proust's famous cup of tea.
That was wonderful. Thank you. Is it too early to ask a provocative question, you think?
No, but I also want to make sure we talk a little bit about some of the images. So
let's
maybe
ask
we'll
that provocative question afterwards.
Yeah,
then.
let's just spend a little time with this one, and then we'll do the provocative.
So in this image, in particular. We didn't pre-plan too much, but this does remind me, though, to ask you a little bit about the structure of the book, because there is this kind of analogical turn that you do continuously in each chapter.
Yeah.
So it was very pleasurable reading this, to start in this historical space, and then by the end of chapter one, all of a sudden I'm in the present. And so there's this move that happens in every chapter where Kaja's constantly pointing you backwards and forwards, and you're looking in your current space to kind of understand the historical trajectory that you're mapping out. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you came to that decision to land with the present works and some of the structural questions.
Well, I think that I am working always, for a long time now at least, with an implicitly Benjaminian notion of history, so more analogical or figural than not telling, as he puts it, the beads of the rosary, one thing after another thing after another thing. Sometimes that kind of history still turns out to be the important ground, as Homé and I have talked about it, which is transected by this other kind of history, which is analogical connections that can be across vast stretches of time and unlikely places. Kinship, like rainbows, kinship rainbows, I'm making that up. I think that might be overdone. Kinship rainbows.
Kinship rainbows.
You know, rainbow has a foot in two different places, but no, we'll let that go. So I think that I see the recovery within the present of the lost potential of these earlier technologies. That is, what the camera obscura made possible is sealed over and closed off, but it is recoverable from a later moment in time, and Morel does that with this. John Dugdale does it, John Dugdale's self-portrait with Keats' death mask, which is on the cover of my book, does it with a cyanotype, and so does Barbara Kasten, and also, of course, with photogenic, the whole notion of the photogenic. Mm-hmm. So those are affiliations somehow.
Yes. So in a way, we have here a perfect example that we could, in a way, derive a lot of these concepts that we've been discussing mm-hmm. out of this image, because, okay, first of all, it's a photograph, but in a way, there's at least two photographs here, because it's a photograph of an image that essentially is a camera obscura image, and this room itself is a camera, right? Anyone who's had this sort of marvelous, really wondrous experience of being in a room where the curtains are slightly ajar and suddenly you have a projected image of the outside world on the wall. That's what this is, but in a really spectacular form. And we have there's a photograph of something that's in a way already a photograph in the richer sense. And then we have so many temporal indices here. We have Central Park, and it's clearly autumn, as we can tell by the colors of the foliage. And I mean, I assume that he had to wait for this image. The light had to be exactly right. The angle had to be exactly right. It wasn't a process of creating or staging or making. It's about, in a way, waiting. And so, I mean, I'm just picturing him sitting and maybe adjusting the aperture slightly, and in a way the weather is dependent. So there's so much going on here that has to do with reception and duration. And then, in a way, also just the mapping of a more archaic photographic technology onto that's now being rendered visible by his camera that took this picture that we're looking at now.
Yeah.
So maybe you could talk about those two cameras.
Well, something we haven't talked about yet is this fascinating phenomenon that, again, occurs first with the camera obscura in the 18th century, and then in the early discourse on photography, that the pencil that draws the photographic image or the camera obscura image is the pencil of nature, and that the photograph, whether we understand that as in its elongated ephemeral camera obscura mode, or in the mode that's more familiar to us, is a worldly self-portrait. The world draws its portrait on and gives us, and the gift takes an aesthetic form. These aesthetic criteria are very, very pronounced and very fascinating. And I came across a letter from Alexander Pope, the 18th century poet, in which he described this grotto camera obscura that he had created. And he said, when you close the door of the grotto, you see the trees, the boats, the river painting themselves on the walls of the camera obscura, using also a present tense. They are painting themselves rather than locating it in the past. And so I was so struck by that, by this very beautiful passage from Pope. And somehow whenever I would be lecturing about the camera obscura, I would always show this Morel image as some kind of, this is what I see when I read the Alexander Pope, the sense of the outside world rendering itself in the form of a kind of ontological self-portrait that has the aesthetic properties that we assume generally to be indicative of a human intention, which cannot be attributed to a human intention. That is all very, very striking. And this issue of intentionality is another one that comes up, and also in the second volume very emphatically, this sense that there is an intention behind this solicitation, this self-portraiture that cannot be called subjective, that challenges the whole Cartesian, not just the whole Cartesian tradition, but the whole humanist tradition, is resisted massively through the appearance of tropes of art making, of intentionality, of showing. And then this, of course, is a photograph that receives a image that came into a camera obscura from the world, so it's doubly receptive. And by the way, Abelardo would like to come and live in Philadelphia, and I think we should all send him a letter, a group letter, telling him how happy we would have him. Do you want to just show the other one?
Sure.
Because this one is actually at the PMA. It was made at the PMA, and it's so fascinating, and it brings painting into the equation as well.
I mean, so there's even more we could do with these. There's the it's inverted, and you have this wonderful passage where you talk about, in a way, the corrective inversion, the writing of the image in terms of its orientation, and then also the positive being a correction of the negative, how these corrections are, in a way, distortions, or we could say anthropomorphizations of these images that come from the world. We could talk about, I mean, this in a way goes back to Plato's cave. We have the camera is a room, right? Mm-hmm. And this is appearing in this room, and that in a way is the space. But I also think maybe we could also transition to talk about the relationship between the contemporary photographers who are working in these more archaic techniques. And so Alex and I had been thinking...
The provocative question?
Yes, the provocative question, which... So a lot of the exemplars that you turn to in this book, so Dugdale, who we'll get to soon, and as well as Morel, they're Luddites in a way. They're working with archaic image making processes or tools. Are there contemporary photographers who tap into these developmental aspects of the medium without having to look backward in their image making technologies? And by contrast, are there what was the flip side of that question?
The flip side of that was, are there photographs that may not be photographic in the sense that you're defining them?
So there is, so I distinguish at the end of the book between analogical photography and representational photography. So yes, obviously we did quite a number on photography. But the wonderful thing about photography, which is world-generated, is that it goes elsewhere. And so all these tropes of development, reception, pencil of nature, the whole nine yards show up in Proust, manifestly connected to photography, and Rilke, and Cézanne's The Landscape Paints Itself in Me. That's part of the non-specific. Well, of course, I agree with you that these photographers we've been talking about so far could be called Luddites, although I don't see technology as... So when I talk about development, I'm not talking about technological development. So the normal narrative that would be told about the development of photography would unfold technologically in time. Mm-hmm. So since I don't think about its development that way, but rather movements back and forth between the present and the past, I don't see that as Luddite. Nonetheless, I do talk about Font Huberta, as we all know, who works with Archive Noise and Google Grams, and that is a big part of the second chapter of the book. But I continue to be very interested in artists who, contemporary artists who are working with earlier technologies. And now that you've done the cast, and I realize she's got to be in the book, but also Sally Mann, who works with a collodion wet plate in ways that are heart-stopping.
Well, and that actually leads to another question we had for you, which is what's happening with Volume 2? So it's the history of photography, Part 1,
And possibly
what's next?
3.
Yes, Part 3, Part 4. can you give us a little preview of the next
coming attractions?
Yeah.
There is only supposed to be one more, but it's already outgrowing the one volume, so I don't know how my editor is going to deal with the idea of Volume 3. But I thought that I would be beginning with the pictorialists, with the moment at which human authorship enters the picture. In other words, dealing not just with the pencil of nature and world authorship, but the relationship between that and human authorship. So I'm going, that my destination is large format photography, and specifically Jeff Wall, which is another, all the work I did on Jeff Wall is another one of the places where this project started. So, of course, that means museums, that means exhibition, that means a whole lot of things that don't factor in Volume 1. So I thought that that would all start in the 1850s, and I'm teaching a course right now, and a number of the people in the room are in the seminar called Pictorial Photography, and I thought we would start in the 1850s, which is when photographs begin to be exhibited, and when artists are aspiring to make pictures with a capital P. But it actually begins in 1839 with Hippolyte Bayard, and that has turned out to be an absolute revelation. Today we were at the PMA study room looking at Bayard, and the other people on the seminar, and it's just, he's so fabulous beyond belief, but he did this incredible thing, which is his father grew peaches, but he wanted the peaches, and he sent them in baskets to friends, but he wanted the peaches to be seen as by him as well as from him, so it's an authorial parable. So he created these stencils, his initials with stencils on the peaches, and it is photography for all intents and purposes. The sun would darken the skin around them, and then he would remove the stencils, and there his initials would be, and he would put one of those signed peaches in each basket of peaches that he sent to his friends. And Bayard always told that story, and his version of his father's stencils is the attempt to establish himself as an artist, to give himself the right to be an artist, given that the pencil of nature is busily browning his photographs like his father's peaches, by being the inventor of his own medium. So authorship is a huge problem from 1839 on. Hippolyte Bayard is the only artist, the only photographer at the beginning who wants to be an artist. The others want to be the inventors. And therefore, all of these dilemmas don't emerge, but they do with Bayard. And he in 1839, put 30 of his photographs in a large frame and hung them in an art exhibition in Paris. It's just unimaginable. And everybody who saw the show, he stole the show, his little tiny photographs. So somehow he sensed, in order to author a photograph, it has to be framed, it has to hang on a wall. But the idea that you could put 30 inside a single frame, at any rate, you look at the photographs from that period, and they have internalized the frame. It's not just that they had an literal frame around a whole bunch of them, but he has grasped the pictorial principles already at that moment early in photography. And when he is not acknowledged as one of the inventors of photography, he stages his own death. So that's the other incredibly exciting thing, that the death of the author happens in 1839 through photography and not through Mallarmé, and has nothing whatever to do with impersonal authors, because by our film makes three photographs of himself as a drowned author who has committed suicide because he was not acknowledged. And there are many other twists and turns of the story that are absolutely riveting. So that turned out to be something that I didn't think I would be starting with and devoting a whole chapter to. And the second chapter does then deal with these 1850s, and the whole century is full of agitation about authorship. It just goes on from one end to the other within photography, and the way that these photographers who would be authors always try to establish themselves as having bona fide authorial chops is by saying, as one of them puts it, it's a very severe mental practice. So the whole of the humanist discourse, Leonardo's account of the painter as someone who and whose work begins in his head and then is born in the head and then it is transferred ideationally, it is born somewhere where only human beings could author anything which is in the human brain. That all returns in this long 19th century. And then I'm doing the pictorialists, and Steichen is of particular interest to me, and somewhere along the way.
So two things from, the, I mean, wow, what a story. Incredible. I mean, the first has to do with abstraction, which is one way that the authorial impulse tries to assert itself with photography, and that brings me back, though, to Kasten as well, who's abstraction, but also, in a way, opposite of that impulse. So that's one. And then two, the story of the peaches just makes me think, it's so incredible to think all of these people who were trying to develop a process to make a print and to save and preserve. And meanwhile, the world is full of photosensitive surfaces.
Absolutely. Right.
They're everywhere. You know, almost everything organic and even inorganic materials are photosensitive. Right. And in a way, the kind of just absurdity and pathos of that quest. So.
Yeah. I was at Dartmouth at a critical theory seminar, and somebody, a poet, was pressing me on the... why photography? Why is photography the world's primary way of showing itself to us? And I said, well, because light cannot be... Light is as old as we are to begin with, and it irreducibly comes from an exterior source. Words we can claim to be the origin of, but all of the images that Aristotle and Alhazen and all of the other people who discovered the camera obscura principles early on saw, they just saw photographs that were being created during solar eclipses or in the intervals between the leaves on a tree, and the kind of assertion of the exteriority that there is a world. It precedes us. It exceeds us. It's not for us. We are for it. All of these assertions that photography in all of its visual forms is able to make so emphatically, I think, can be more easily neutralized when it takes other forms than light-born ones.
And that actually leads me to a question about one of your own provocations, and where you land, and the image that you choose to put on the cover of your book, and really conclude a meditation on with a photographer who can't see.
Yeah,
I mean, I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that.
So, how are we doing time-wise? Are we pretty much at the end of our time?
Before we open to questions?
Should we, maybe we should transition
it's to perfect.
The reading.
We're fine. Okay, so...
So maybe we could bring the Dugdale up on the screen.
I was actually going to talk about the Reiki first, the Civil War.
Sorry, okay. Yes. Let's do that.
So
I'm going to read two short discussions of... Did we actually get
we
that?
Oh, we had all of the images. Oh, well, we could... We can pull some things up.
Tell me when to stop.
Okay, well, just go back to... So... yeah, go forward to the liquid photography chapter. Okay, back to the camera obscura diagram.
I should mention that this is a lavishly illustrated publication, and it's very rewarding. I mean, you really give the reader a lot to look at, not just to think about, which is... very pleasurable.
Good, thank you.
But this is just a sneak peek. I mean, all of these things are throughout.
So I just wanted to put this up because there's a feature of photography that's there in all of the forms that it takes, which I talk about in volume one, but whose social ramifications become much more evident in the second chapter. Actually, I'll be reading one of the photographs I'll be discussing, it is already evident, but that is this recto verso relationship. So as you can see, the camera obscura image, when light rays enter a small aperture, they cross each other, producing a laterally reversed, an upside down and laterally reversed image. And what Leonardo realized early on is that is also true of human vision, that the human eye functions like a camera obscura. To make matters from a humanist point of view even worse, we have two separate camera obscurae, and we don't actually see what either one of them receives because our optical system condenses them into a single upright, non-reversed image with depth. But at any rate, the reason this is so important is that it is a form of relationality that is based upon reversibility and implicitly, therefore, I think, reciprocity. We could imagine somebody being inside the camera obscura and receiving that image, but exchanging positions with a strange figure outside, and that reversal, which I call the chiasmus, being affected there. Can you just move forward one? So to make this a little bit clearer, Henry Fox Talbot discovered what we call the negative-positive technology, but he didn't call it negative-positive. He was interested in what he called the first or white image, which he regarded as a photograph in and of itself, and he called it a reversal in the sense that the camera obscura's image is a reversal, an inversion and a lateral reversal. But he called then the positive when he started making it a reversal of the reversal. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of, there is a reversibility between those two. And the same principle shows up in the shot reverse shot in cinema. It's present in the structure of the stereoscope, although I won't go into that. And it's part, I think, of large format, contemporary large format photography. So it's the socially redemptive aspect of photography. Anyway, that I just wanted to say that quickly. So,
well, and then at some point we stop seeing it as the reversal of the reversal.
Yeah.
We start seeing it just as this negative-positive relationship, and the positive becomes this one-to-one relationship, which is
a very different story. Yeah. And also, of course, if it's a reversible reversal, this forward march, this kind of teleological impulse is absolutely thwarted. And I guess in a way I'm going in reverse at certain moments when you call what you call my Luddite moments. That wasn't such a provocation, by the way. That's pretty mild. I'm sure I'm going to get worse than that.
Softball. but yeah, no, I mean, this brings us back in a way to the analogy, which is in the title of your book, and how it's really a way of thinking about pairs that is not about binary opposition.
Yeah.
In a way,
you're deconstructing the sort of master binary opposition between right. similarity and difference. And here we have two that are a black and a white image that are not opposed. They're yeah. in a very different mm-hmm. kind of relationship to yeah. each other.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I think so, too. So I'm going to talk first about, I'm going to read first my reading of this photograph. So I conclude chapter 4 with a powerfully disclosive photograph from the 1860s, John Rickey's A Burial Party at the Battleground of Cold Harbor, April 1865. The two figures in this photograph are engaged in a grim task, burying the remains of thousands of Union soldiers who were killed in two battles the preceding year, both of which were fought on this site. Since they have been lying there for a long time, these remains are sparse, some bleached skulls, a jumble of other bones, a boot, and tattered bits of clothing. They are piled on an angled stretcher in the foreground of the photograph, behind which one of the men is crouching. He looks directly out at us from the left side of the photograph. The skull that is most proximate to him also faces us. The other men have shovels and are dispersed across a field that extends from the stretcher to the trees at the rear of the image. Two of them appear to be digging graves, and the fourth is standing beside a mound of earth. They all look down at the ground from which they came and to which they will one day return. The photograph speaks volumes about America's still palpable racial divide. The men in the burial party are all African American, and they are interring the remains of Northern soldiers in Virginia, a slave state. Although they are not slaves, they are working in a field and doing a job that the local residents refuse to do or even command their slaves to do. One of the men is wearing a Union Army uniform, indicating that he is a soldier and suggesting that this may also be the case with the other men. However, although the ostensible goal of the Civil War was the eradication of slavery in the remaining slave states, African American men were not allowed to join the Union Army until 1863, and when they were finally admitted, they were relegated to separate units and discriminated against in numerous ways. Finally, most, if not all, of the men whose remains they are burying were white. Burial Party is one of a handful of, sorry, is one of the 100 photographs in Gardner's photographic sketchbook of the American Civil War. Gardner credits the negative to Rickey and the positive to himself, just as Sugimoto does, another contemporary artist, with Talbot's photographs in his photographic drawing. Like Sugimoto, Gardner also positions the photograph on the right page and the commentary on the left. He wrote this commentary, and its first sentence is remarkable for what it doesn't say, more remarkable for what it doesn't say than for what it does. Gardner refuses to utter the adjective on the basis of which certain Americans were deemed to be slaves or relegated to a segregated military unit. He identifies the men in the photograph simply as soldiers. He also characterizes their relationship to the fallen men in a surprising way. He writes that they are, quote, in the act of collecting the remains of their comrades. With the last word in this sentence, Gardner declares them to be equal with and ontologically connected to the dead men. The photograph itself goes even further. As Elizabeth Young observes, the, quote, dismembered foot, close quote, in the foreground of the photograph seems an extension of the live African American's body, and the skulls lined up on the stretcher undo all binary oppositions, not just white and black, but north and south, rich and poor, and slave and free man. The skull that faces us also shows us that we are as deep inside this picture as Oliver Holmes was in the pictures of Anne Hathaway's cottage when he noticed the rub marks on her doorway. You'll have to read the book to know what that's about. The skull, however, cannot cross over to our side because its sockets are empty. The real center of the photograph is not it, but the man whose shoulder it seems to touch. He invites us to join the republic for which he stands by using our own being as a means of participating in his. His look is undiminished by time, as Eleanor Jones Harvey puts it, because it does not belong to the past. It is headed toward the present, toward the here and now, in which a potentially infinite series of later looks will both meet it and greet it. And now I'm going to read what I wrote about the cover photograph. The cyanotype on the cover of my book, which is called John Keats's Death Mask, 1999, is by John Dugdale, a contemporary artist who makes photographs in pre-industrial ways and who calls Julia Margaret Cameron his godmother and Talbot an old soulmate. The artist appears in the lower left side of the image, facing the camera, and the eponymous death mask occupies a similar position on the right. Dugdale supports his plaster companion and grazes the latter's cheek with his own. Like Dothenday and his fiancée, John Keats's death mask is thus both a self-portrait and a portrait of a couple. This photograph, however, was not shot in a studio under tightly controlled conditions. Instead, Dugdale stood at the edge of the woods near his friend Maurice Sendek's home in Ridgefield, Connecticut, at twilight one evening in 1999, while someone else exposed the negative. And rather than directing a hard, manly look at the camera, the artist shut his eyes. Dugdale's eyes are closed in this and many of his other photographs because he is blind. He lost all of his vision in one eye and 80% of his vision in the other in 1994 as a result of a cataclysmic series of health crises precipitated by the human autoimmune deficiency virus. He lost his remaining vision in 2010, but Dugdale's eyes would also be closed if this were not the case, because he knows that they are not the locus of vision. Sight does not reside in your eyes, he declares in Life's Evening Hour, his first book of photographs. It exists in your mind and heart, close quote. He also knows that the camera isn't an extension of his look. Photography means drawing with light, he observes in another passage in Life's Evening Hour, and the photographer is the recipient, not the creator, of the resulting image. Would you just go forward one, because there's another Dugdale. Yeah. The passage that I've just quoted accompanies a cyanotype that was made at Laycock Abbey, which was Talbot's estate, and that references Talbot's earliest extant photograph, Oriel Window. Standing in front of this window, Dugdale recounts in the same passage, he felt light falling on his body just as it had fallen on Talbot's sensitized paper. The artist's comparison of his body to a photographic negative is the physical counterpart of the concept mobilized by Cézanne, Rilke, and Proust to describe the receptivity of their artistic practice, the concept of the psychic photographic plate. Dugdale characterizes himself as a receiver in another way in a gallery statement, writing, quote, the quietude that people respond to in my pictures is in part because of the way the pictures are made. No flash, no hands, no hard electric light, not even the sound of the shutter, just the lens cap removed and then gently replaced, close quote. Dugdale refers to the photographs in Life's Evening Hour as likenesses. Since these photographs are staged and his sitters often assume fictional personae, their similarity might seem to be the kind to which Walter Benjamin objects and which he associates with a transitional generation of industrial photographers. Dugdale, however, always introduces us to his models so that we know whose likeness we are observing, and he often describes the situation out of which the photograph emerged. And not only is John Keats's death mask a likeness of the artist holding a death mask, but the death mask is also a likeness of John Keats and of a very particular kind. Like Talbot's photogenic drawing, which resemble their cause, and the shell, this is another reference I'm afraid that you'll have to read the book to get, and the shell described by Benjamin, which extends outward from and conforms to the mollusk, a death mask analogizes the face that shaped it. John Keats's death mask also discloses other resemblances that cannot be attributed to a human author. Dugdale's features and the shape of his face are strikingly similar to those of his plaster companion, and the latter's eyes are also closed. Although the photograph is a monochrome and therefore chromatically non-representational, the field of cyan blue that fills the upper third of the photograph resembles the light that created it. The twilight, Dugdale told me, is what gives the picture its soft glow, close quote. The chemicals used in the cyanotype process have also sprinkled delicate freckles over the bodies of both figures, transforming plaster into flesh and making Dugdale's hand seem like the organic extension of the mask's face. And instead of rending asunder what analogy has joined together, the composition reinforces these connections. Not only are both figures located in the lower part of the image, with the one on the left occupying a comparable position to the one on the right, but both are busts, both their heads are level, and they are sheltered beneath the same sky. Finally, instead of banishing other intentionalities, as Dothenday attempts to do, Dugdale invites them in. Some of these intentionalities are objective. They originate in the phenomenal world and enter with the light. Others, though, are emphatically human. Quote from him, "The heartfelt grace and love that people bring to my pictures when viewing them is a gift to me of inestimable value," he writes in Life's Evening Hour, "a gift that keeps me whole and alive," close quote. He provides a similar account of his models, quote, "When the floodlight is on and I focus the camera on people, I find they're touched by inspiration and our session becomes a give and take between the photographer and the subject. We're orchestrating, creating a picture together, a process I cherish," close quote. Instead of telling his sitters what to do, Dugdale directs them by assuming the position that he wants them to assume, and he sometimes asks them to focus his camera. Since Dugdale is the only person in John Keats's death mask, it might seem less chiasmatic, less reciprocal and reversible than the photographs described in the previous paragraph. But the death mask belonged to Sendak, and it was at his request that the cyanotype was made. And although neither Dugdale nor Sendak may have realized this, the photograph is also a visual antiphon to one of Keats's own utterances, "Tender is the night," the poet remarks in Ode to a Nightingale, "and there never was one more tender than this." And although there is usually nothing more redolent of absence than a death mask, this mask functions like an early photograph. It is the vehicle through which Keats' presence is. Finally, when placed side by side with eyes that not only cannot see, but that cannot, unlike Dugdale's, open, something even more miraculous happens. Dugdale's closed eyes become a return look. Since these transformations occur within the frame of a cyanotype, they reactivate chemical photography's its own presentational powers. I'm going to read that sentence again. Since these transformations occur within the frame of a cyanotype, they reactivate chemical photography's own presentational powers, its capacity to disclose the world and to solicit a response. As we gaze at John Keyes's death mask, the medium becomes again what it was in 1839, the highest form of poesis.